Andrew Ford writes music and Ben Quilty is a painter. And apart from being very talented, arty and incredibly nice blokes, they're neighbours in the country. But they have very different ways of doing things. Hello, I'm Kirsty Melville and this is the Earshot podcast. In this episode, Ben is back from a tour of refugee camps in the Middle East and Europe, with experiences that feel just too big for a canvas. He finds inspiration in Andrew's orchestral piece, Blitz, about the children who survived the bombing of Liverpool and Hamburg in World War II. But how and why do they tackle such big themes and turn the suffering of life into art? Today, Ben and Andy talk about life, art, and the human cost of war.
My name's Ben Quilty. I'm an artist and I live and work in a little green village on the side of a hill in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales. One of my neighbours is the composer, Andy Ford. We're separated literally by three front doors and a big misty paddock.
Good morning.
Some days, Andy drops by my studio for a chat.
Oh, I love the music.
I might turn it down a little bit, Andy, though. This is my normal, insane level.
That's a good idea.
Come through to the studio.
This is Robert Plant. Do you paint to Robert?
Well, I paint to everything. Paint to Andy Ford occasionally. Come through and have a look at the studio, mate. This is the room that I come to every morning and wish that I was at the beach, Andy, to be quite honest with you.
I don't believe you. First thing that I notice is that you've got several paintings on the go. There's lots of unfinished work here on your walls.
I do. It's not always like this, but I've recently been wanting to make much larger works and I need to slow the process down. I need to be more patient. So, for example, this work here is a very, very big canvas that I've been working on with Kylie, my Kylie. She's now stood for me or sat for me in traditional term four or five times and slowly building up an image. So, in a sense, just slowing my practice down because there's no way of making something that big in one day, which was my way before.
So before you'd have a sitter. And you'd finish the piece by the end of the day.
I finish having that sitter, yes. So I might rework the painting, but, I mean, for example, the Afghanistan paintings, they're all made in one sitting and then possibly rearranged a little bit when the subject had gone. But I think the way life is, I think hundreds of years ago, subjects could sit for many days. Things were much slower. And now, with the pace that we all live, it's a big ask to get someone to sit for more than 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, absolutely, unless she's your wife, of course.
Unless, correct, unless it's Kylie. I hope you're not listening, Kylie.
But I think I always assumed that you had made drawings or taken photographs and then done the paintings later.
I did. I made a lot of drawings in Afghanistan. There's copies of them, and they hold a great meaning for me as a record of sitting with this man in Tarankod in the belting sun, finding a shady spot, and then sitting down and getting him to sit still for half an hour or an hour to make the drawing. And there's something contained in that record of making a work with someone that is very personal, and it speaks to their humanity and our relationship. So when I got back, I started with the drawings. The drawings and photographs, but I very soon realised I needed those subjects in the studio with me, and so we then got them in and had them sit and made the works from life, and instantly, with such extraordinary young people who've had such massive life experiences, it's hard to go wrong in some senses.
Look, the other thing is that there are army fatigues, or what look like army
cams, cams from Afghanistan
on the floor, and there's also quite a lot of life jackets.
Yes, the cams actually were given to me by my friends from all different units. After I returned from Afghanistan, they'd come and sit, and they're actually a very strangely precious symbol for these young people of their service. They help them disappear into the Afghan landscape, which meant that they were safe from the harm of AK-47 bullets. But then when they get home, they're just these sort of completely useless objects, and they handed them to me, quite ceremoniously, I guess. And for me, they protect me from the paint in the studio. I don't know. They're a meaningful thing for me, and a great honour that those young people let me have their old cams to then use in my studio.
And the life jackets are also protection, aren't they?
They are, although some of them don't actually work, and we've tested them out. They're filled up with fake flotation devices. I've just been on a trip with my friend and famous author Richard Flanagan, toured by World Vision through along the Syrian border in Lebanon, through the Bekaa Valley and Beirut and Bosnia, Serbia, and finally to Lesvos in Greece to follow the trail of the refugees out of Syria, and then to respond to it. And right now, to be honest with you, Andy, you've walked in when I feel like the experience is so enormous that I am not quite sure yet how to respond in any meaningful way. But the life jackets, obviously, again, it's like having a young man who's returned from Afghanistan. To have them here, in a sense, those life jackets for me are that same thing. They're about hope, but terrible sadness and loss. I just have a drawing that I wanted to show. Oh, here she is. So this is a drawing that I've been trying to translate into a large-scale painting, which you can see here. And this very quiet young woman, the drawing that I made of her was the day after she'd buried her little four-year-old boy who drowned on the crossing in a rubber boat from Turkey over to Lesvos. So this drawing for me is, in a sense, there's not much more that I could say than what's contained in this drawing and my experience of sitting in front of her eyes that were completely hollow, her shoulders that were falling away, and her husband who sat next to her, who I also drew, complete despair, and leaving that little tiny child's body on a Greek isle that they'd never in their wildest nightmares thought that they'd need to approach the way they did. But the problem with the drawing is that it's a little piece of paper. It's not a big and bold enough statement for me to actually communicate what needs to be communicated for people to realise that she's a human, a beautiful soul, a grieving mother, and hence this big painting. But again, it's the first version, and it seems like so many profoundly enormous issues through what I've just seen, I'm not quite sure yet how to do them justice.
No. And ultimately, I guess you can't. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. And look,
I mean, there's no way you can make a painting that approaches her grief. I mean, you know, art in a sense is impotent, isn't it, in the face of something like that?
It is, but it seems futile not to try. And the life jackets. Obviously, I picked up little life jackets. This is made for a little person. And was worn by a little person. So someone fitted into these things. And when they get out, I'm sure that their parents and the little person that wore this tiny little life vest would hope that they never needed a life vest again and discard them on the beach.
Yes, yes. Yes, the discarding of it is a sort of almost like a defiant act, isn't it?
For me, that's what it felt like. But when you then talk to the people, when they get out of these boats, even on the calmest day in that water, they are soaking wet. And we Richard and I went to the beach and watched boats come, and it was a beautiful, clear, very cold day, but all the people on those boats were wet when they arrived. So this is another drawing by a little fella that Richard writes very beautifully about. But this little fella sat and drew and drew and drew, and it's his home.
the helicopter.
The thing that confronted me most about these children's drawings, they know exactly what this helicopter looks like. And media's shut down there. There's no TV coverage for them to see that image. They see that image with their own eyes above their homes and then are able to recall it in great detail on these bits of paper with the flood of red bullets coming out and ISIS flags and dead people and no child, no human really should be able to draw that, having first-hand witness to something so horrendous. Thinking about my own response to what I saw in refugee camps in the Beka Valley and on Lesbos and through Serbia, I've been listening to one of Andy's pieces. It's called Blitz.
Looking back, it was a totally bizarre time.
We hear first-hand accounts by children who survived the aerial bombing of Liverpool, Hamburg, and Berlin in World War II.
It's what you accept, isn't it? That was your life. At four, you wouldn't know any different, would you?
Too young to be afraid, I think. Didn't understand.
That was it. That was life.
By the time Andy interviewed them, these little children were in their 80s.
I was only four when it started, but I do remember not being bombed out, but being what they call blasted, and all the windows were blasted in. And I was rolled in a blanket and passed out the window.
We all knew the Germans' planes, because they were drum, drum, drum.
They were the baddies.
Drum, drum. That was the sound of the planes going
They were the baddies, and we were the goodies, of course.
If there was no raid, we either got under the kitchen table, or, more often, under the stairs. I wasn't got a room under the stairs.
My brother and I would sleep underneath the dining room table.
Andy, with Blitz, let me ask you, what brought you to tell the voice through adults' words?
It started with me thinking I would like to record the voices of my parents and that I would like to record some of the stories that I had heard growing up of their childhood experiences in Liverpool, England, during the war. Liverpool was, after London, Liverpool was the second most heavily bombed city in the UK. When I was a child, I remembered hearing these stories that were kind of strange and exciting and hard to imagine in a way of my parents as children. You know, the night that the incendiary bomb came through the roof of my mother's house, and the night that the whole window was blown in, the window frame and everything was blown in on top of the table in the dining room, and my father and his brother were sleeping, as children were sleeping under the table, and the window frame came in. These sorts of stories. And the funny thing was that as I got older, I found them, in a sense, less easy to understand and believe. It seemed kind of so remote from any experience I had had. So that was the start of it. And then one thing sort of led to another, and I thought, oh, maybe I can make a piece of music out of this. So I also recorded interviews with a couple of their friends, same generation, and then I thought, I was actually flying over.
You crossed the channel.
I was flying over Germany, and I thought, I should probably talk to some Germans as well. And so I went to Hamburg and recorded a long conversation with a fascinating woman there who had lived in Barmbek, which is one of the areas of Hamburg which was completely destroyed by the RAF bombing, and is still is back living in Barmbek now in a nice apartment. And that was very strange as well. Anyway, the thing took shape very gradually. And as I was then working on the piece, which turned out to be an orchestral piece commissioned by the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra, I started to think. I mean, there was all of the Syria thing was happening on TV. This is 2010, 2011. And, you know, there are children underneath bombs. And I felt that the piece that I was writing, although ostensibly about World War II, was actually much bigger than World War II, that it was a piece which was about children in harm's way. But you see, I can't do what you do, really. You can go and look at these children and meet these children and meet their parents and draw them and offer them something in a sense that as a composer, particularly a composer of an orchestral piece, I can't really do. And the other thing is that I can't immediately translate what is happening now into music. There would be, to me, something kind of a bit obscene about putting the voices of the children you met recently into a piece of music. And I think it's because of the nature of music. Benjamin Britten said this thing about how that one of the problems of music is that it's so beautiful. And it's very difficult to use music in a way which will show you something which isn't beautiful.
But to that point, I think that if you had the voices of those children once they'd arrived in Germany, having survived their experience, which is why I thought the Blitz was such a beautifully poetic idea, that those little children's feet grew adults and lived a life, and that's therefore innate sense of hope in the piece is a very moving thing. I think any time that children have survived and passed through that experience, then giving voice to them is just one step for them to heal a little bit more and gradually grow their feet into adults.
Yes, I suppose so. I hadn't actually thought of Blitz like that. Partly because during the course of working on it and during the course of recording these interviews, I learned much more about the bombing of Germany. I hadn't really appreciated how cataclysmic it was. You know, in the Second World War, in the whole of the Second World War, about 4,000, a bit more than 4,000 people died in Liverpool in the bombings in December 1940 and May 1941. That was the worst of it. But in Hamburg in July 1943, in three nights of bombing, 45,000 people died. So it's on a completely different scale. And I'm not sure that the people who survived that bombing actually, in a sense, are so full of hope, partly because it was something which wasn't really much addressed after the war. They didn't really talk about it. You know, the tone of the memories of my mum and dad and their friends, there was a little bit of, you know, who do you think you're kidding, Mr. Hitler? You know, there was a kind of jokiness to some of it, not all of it, because they were recalling, you know, death and the death of children, in fact. But some of it was kind of, you know, this is a tremendous adventure, but there was none of that from the German people that I interviewed.
Oh, that's interesting.
They had when the subject came up, they became very, very somber.
When we came out in the daytime, I looked at it, and at children, you look, you don't get it straight away, what's going on, what happened, you know? Then it's scary. Then we said to my mother, what is that? And what? And then you see, you know, bodies in, and you see the plants, and then you see the trees cut down. And while we had that big park around us, and the playgrounds, it was all nice and green and trees, you know, I mean, that all went into fire, and it all exploded.
Unbelievable.
It disaster.
Because where rows of houses used to be, there was nothing but rubbles, piles of rubbles of stone.
Es war, alles war zerstört, alles war kaputt, also dass man schon Angst kriegte, manchmal auf die Straße zu gehen, weil man vielleicht noch Körper gefunden hätte. Find no still bodies, you know. Then with the phosphor, when it hit, a lot of people got burned. Und dann war die Armee da oder die Volunteers, die dann die Körper zusammengesammelt haben. Who collected the bodies and put them on tracks and wherever they took them.
Horses, dead horses, people went out with knives and cut open the horses and got the meat out to take it home. That's what I visually can still see. People, they're cutting open horses to get food.
But what I liked, and it was partly a musical thing, was the idea of elderly voices telling childish memories.
Yes, I loved that part of it. That there was that travel, that there was that time had passed, and that therefore it was hopeful. But that's very sad to hear that those German people didn't inhabit the same space in a sense.
No, I don't think you could if you'd been through that complete
annihilation.
Annihilation. Yes, I mean they were lucky that they survived. Of course that. That they managed to get to the shelters, but when they came out of the shelters, there was nothing.
They were high up in the sky. We could see the, I'm not English, but Kondensstreifen in the air and the humming sound. There was no end to it. There were thousands of them in the air. Ein Brausen.
I met another little girl in a transfer camp in Serbia. It was minus 16 degrees in the middle of the day, and this tiny little child, whose name was Heba, was wearing a very dark blood red parka and a bright pink beanie and a little tiny mauve skivvy under her clothes, and all these clothes had been handed to her after she'd got off a boat some time before then. All of them had crossed that same water, but she'd made it all the way with her father and mother to Serbia and onwards, finally, I hope by now, to Germany. But her name was Heba, and in a sense, everything I've done since then, I feel like it is for Heba. And I'm even signing off my emails at the moment for Heba, and it's a bit of a hollow gesture, but she's the same age as my daughter. In fact, on the beach of Lesvos, and you can see on that stool there, amongst the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of life jackets are also the clothes that people tear off as soon as they make it in the middle of the night. And it's obviously the snow-covered mountains in Greece at this time of year. They throw their clothes onto the ground and they try and light fires to warm themselves up, literally to survive the hypothermia that sets in so quickly after an experience like that. And I found a little set of pyjamas thrown in the bushes on top of the beach that would fit my little girl. And there's not much more profound symbol than that. Back to Heba, this is a drawing that Heba made, and you can't but feel helpless as an artist, as we spoke about, but to give those children beautiful quality coloured pencils, watercolour pencils, and beautiful handmade paper, and to get them to record their memories. And I asked Heba, who did not who did not stop drawing the entire time I sat with her, I asked her at one point to stop drawing the beautiful things of Syria and draw her home, and she drew this.
Is that a tent?
This is her little home down here. With a helicopter, which if you look, it's an incredible copy of a Russian attack helicopter with barrel bombs coming down, and her neighbours who've been killed at the bottom next to her home. And to be quite honest, this drawing, I can't better that drawing in terms of telling of the horror of what one little six-year-old has been through.
I can see why you, on your return, you wanted to spend a long time painting your wife.
That's part of it as well, yeah. Yeah.
Andy Ford and Ben Quilty. Three Front Doors and a Paddock was produced by Lorena Allam and Mark Don. You can see Ben's sketches on our website, where you'll also find a link to Richard Flanagan's story about their trip. And you can read all about the story of Andy Ford's Blitz. The stories of the Liverpool survivors really are gripping. And this was the second in our series of four conversations between Ben and Andy about creativity. If you missed the first one or you want to listen to them all now, you can listen online or you can download the episodes from the Earshot website, the ABC Radio app, or on iTunes. In the next episode, the business of making art. Andrew works on commission while Ben avoids it like the plague, but they do agree that putting a creative head above the parapet takes courage and, in dealing with the critics, a very thick skin. So do join me again for the next episode, which is coming right up in your podcast feed. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I'll catch you then.